And, well, now we're very happy to have with us Fred Jerome. Are you there, Fred?
Yep, just got here.
You just made it.
Right.
Well, that's we were watching. We have a drone that keeps track. We're very presidential. You wrote an article for Salon Magazine Saturday, January the 18th, 2014, and it was part of an effort. I guess it was organized by Francis Golden. It's a book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA.
Correct.
Is this an essay from that book?
It's an essay from that book. The book has chapters or essays by some 30 different people on various aspects of life and what they might be like under socialism in the USA. And mine is about the media under socialism.
Mm-hmm.
I call it first class news.
Salon made it, what was it, Goodbye Rush?
Salon just picked that one to put on there after the book was published about a month ago.
Yeah.
It's available on Amazon, I guess, and mm-hmm. other places. Imagine Living in the Socialist USA. And Salon picked that one and put it on there and put it up.
Well, that's terrific. By the way, could you tell us, this book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, Frances Goldman is a literary agent. Is that right?
She's my literary agent, among others, as well as other people.
Uh-huh.
And she's one of three editors. The other two editors are Michael Smith and his wife, Debbie Smith. Mm-hmm. Michael Smith is a lawyer. I can't give you too much. I mean, there's more information in the book about everyone, but he's on a program that Pacifica Radio has called Law and Disorder. He's one of three lawyers, I think, who do that.
Hmm. Well, it is interesting. I understand she said that this is something she had a lifelong desire to publish this book, and she argued very persuasively for it. And you know, I guess, could you address this? I mean, it seems to me there has always been a socialist trend of thought in American life. Some of the greatest figures in American history actually have been socialists.
Absolutely.
And it does, on the one hand, it sort of jars the ear, because if we were to go across the U.S. media spectrum, we wouldn't know any socialism was out there. But this book seems to be proving there is.
And I think the book is so far doing well. I mean, I can't give you the statistics, but it seems to be doing well. And I would only tell you also that there was a recent survey poll by the Pew Foundation, which does all kinds of polls, as you may know, mm-hmm. and they found that 49% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 say they have a positive view of socialism. Now,
wow.
considering what has been in the media or what has not been in the media, it's quite, I think, encouraging but surprising.
Mm-hmm.
And they also found that a majority of African Americans whom they asked had a positive view of socialism.
Mm-hmm. And of course, knowing African American history, and this is Black History Month, you think of W.E.B. Du Bois, and you think of Paul Robeson, and you realize, well, these guys
Absolutely.
Are socialists.
Absolutely, yes.
It's not a secret in the Black community that a good number of the bravest and most brilliant leaders have been socialists.
Yes, and I should mention, I can talk about it more later, but one of the three books about Einstein's politics that I've done that have been published is called Einstein on Race and Racism, and that book details and his friendship with Paul Robeson and his support for Du Bois and his support for socialism. And he did an essay called Why Socialism, which was published in 1949 in the first issue of Monthly Review magazine, which is a socialist magazine that still comes out.
Mm-hmm. It was Paul Sweezy, a former Harvard guy.
Correct.
Yeah. By the way, that is a wonderful book. I hope people have seen it and would get a copy. It's, of course, available. You go to Amazon, but it's on race and racism. And a detail from that people need to appreciate the work of Fred Jerome and on Einstein is that there are shelves and shelves of studies and histories and biographies of Einstein, but until you put your book out, it wasn't known that Einstein, together with Robeson, fought for a law banning or preventing lynching in America.
That's correct. And I should say that book, I've done 3 books on Einstein's politics. That book, Einstein, Race and Racism, was done with a co-author, Roger Taylor, and I just want to be sure and mention that. And in fact, what we found and what we put in the book is that in 1946, at a time when African-American GIs were coming back from World War II, where they had fought against fascism, fought to defeat fascism in Europe and Asia, they found that the same mentality existed here, and there was a wave of lynching targeting returning black GIs. Something like 60 GIs were killed, mostly in the southern states, not only in the southern states, but primarily in the southern states, as they were returning from the war. And that's when Robeson and Einstein co-chaired a group called the American Crusade to End Lynching, which then had a demonstration in Washington and so on. There's more about that in the book.
Mm-hmm. This is, again, it's Fred Jerome, and the article he's written is in Salon, and it's January 18, Saturday, January the 18th, and it, of course, is from the book Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. Now, the approach you took was to point out, among other things, that the American media is very much monopolized, and so the idea, many people say, well, I don't, you know, socialism is, you know, you wouldn't have freedom of thought.
Right.
You point out that you're pretty much in Murdoch's world, the rest of at the moment, right?
It's ironic that you planned this program for today, because in my chapter, right at the outset, I say that I said that 20 years ago, 30 corporations controlled 90% of the U.S. media. And today, a grand total of 6 corporations, and then I list them, Murdoch's one of them, Time Warner, CBS, and Comcast, and so on, 6 corporations control the U.S. media. And by the time this program is over today, Phil, it may be 5.
Really?
Well, if Comcast buys Time Warner, which is, I mean, it won't be by the time this program is over, but it's in the works.
Well, we'll tell them to hurry, yeah. We need the story.
It's been in the news.
I did. Now that you mention it, I did see there are a couple of essays published today on the internet. I'm seeing headlines telling us that Comcast is taken over and
right. Well, they haven't.
And how bad this will be.
It hasn't quite been approved yet, but all of our cable bills will surely go up, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of ironic that in my chapter that's the third paragraph in the chapter, and I talk about that and talk about how the media companies, now 5 or 6 or 5 media corporations, are gigantic corporations, and that the only thing I would say that in addition to making their own profits, they're sort of I use the term their daily trumpets for the rest of the corporate world's advertising, and so that they don't make their money from the nickels and dimes or quarters now or dollars that we spend to buy the newspapers, but rather primarily from the advertising,
mm-hmm.
and that are inside them. And so while the big advertisers don't directly control what's in the papers. The papers, the editors, and this is true of television and radio news as well, because they get advertising.
Mm-hmm.
They know what they don't cross the advertisers if they can help it, and they usually can help it.
Yes, it is interesting. We do get evidence of this once in a while. Someone will have a TV show or does something and says something out of line. And instead of saying, well, we turn to the public, what they do is they say, so-and-so, the big advertiser, has indicated they are going to withdraw from that program, and suddenly whoever said that has already gone. I mean,
Exactly. And they don't need to do that very often, because if you've ever worked for a newspaper or a media company, you know what they want, they make it clear. I mean, I remember working for a newspaper years and years ago, and the publisher would come in once a year, and he said, okay, I want you to do a story about the Newsboys who started out delivering papers around the block and now have made $1 million. And every year that story ran in the paper I was working for.
It'd be Horatio Alger.
Right, exactly, exactly.
You were supposed to do that. By the way, my memory, I was reading, I think it was Mark Twain. He was always in the newspaper business. He basically began writing because he said he had to fill the holes, right? They had to be advertising, so
he said,
it had to be a long joke or a short joke.
Well, he said, I went to work as a newspaper man. I hated to do it, but I couldn't find an honest job.
By the way, that leads me to another something I've often quoted, and this is, by the way, an American socialist, but well-known novelist, Theodore Dreiser.
Yes.
Dreiser said something really dark once, which I appreciated. He said, "In America, we don't need freedom of the press; we need freedom from it."
Yes.
And what I assumed what he was driving at is that these monopolies who now have complete death grip on what we know are making sure that we are sort of hammered with whatever is important to them. And in that sense, he thought we need to escape that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think more recently there was the Indian socialist and wonderful commentator Arundhati Roy wrote, this was about 2 or 3 years ago, she said it would be foolish to expect objective reporting, not because journalists are bad people, but because the economic structure of the organizations they work for makes it happen. And it's just that they are in it, you know, the media business and the corporations who own it and run it are not just trying to make money. I mean, they're not just opening up a store to make a profit on what they sell. Mm-hmm. They're also in it because they're pushing a political agenda. Mm-hmm. And they're pushing their candidates or their wars, and that's why you read in the papers that drones almost always hit their targets.
Yeah.
For example, or the recession is over. and that's what you get.
Mm-hmm.
And I just there was a wonderful group called Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, which did a study on, which does many studies on the media, and one that they did recently showed that less than 1% of the news stories in 8 major media outlets covered poverty. despite the fact that 50 million Americans are living officially in poverty, according to the government statistics.
Mm-hmm. Which causes Republican and many Democrats to say, and it's their fault. We don't cover poverty because these are people who don't want to try.
They don't want to try, right. Well, I should mention, when you were talking about people in the past who made comments, that there was a wonderful statement by Upton Sinclair, who was an early American socialist, almost 100 years ago.
Yes.
In the Brass Check, his book called The Brass Check, and he defined American journalism as the day-to-day between election propaganda, whereby the minds of people are kept in a state of acquiescence, so that when the crisis of an election comes, they go to the polls and cast their ballots for either one of the two candidates of their exploiters. Go ahead.
It demonstrates. Sinclair, by the way, is appreciated all over the world, but hardly remembered in the U.S.
Exactly.
Though he was, while in his lifetime, he was irrepressible. I mean,
right.
They couldn't actually defeat him. But when he left the scene, nobody wanted to talk any further about his book, The Brass Check. Although he also scored very heavily with his book about the food industry, probably the greatest victory ever won against monopolies. The title won't come to me at the moment.
And I think I think I mentioned to you once before that he and Einstein exchanged some letters, and I think when he first, Einstein met him in California when he was out there. He said to Einstein, I'm a dangerous man. That was his introduction, his opening comment.
That was to make sure Einstein liked him.
Right. And I should also say that I mentioned Einstein writing in about socialism and why socialism. And I would, if it's okay, I'd just like to read you a couple of
words. Please
do. He also talks about the media, but he starts. He says, I am convinced the only way to eliminate the great evils of capitalism is through the establishment of a socialist economy, accompanied by an educational system which would be oriented towards social goals. A planned economy would distribute the work to be done among all those able to work and would guarantee a livelihood to every man, woman, and child. And then he says, under capitalism, private capitalists inevitably control directly or indirectly the main sources of information, the press, the radio, and I'm sure he would have added TV, and education.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of like, this is 60 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, of course, don't know that Einstein took that position or had that position or much of anything else about him, because he's the fuzzy little genius with the porcupine hair and so on and so forth.
Yes. Rode a bicycle.
Right, exactly.
Yes. We're speaking to Fred Jerome. The article is in Salon on Saturday, January 18, and it's part of a chapter in the book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. Well, I haven't given you a chance to tell us what would it be like to have a socialist press.
Okay. Before I get to that, I just want to mention one other thing. There was the wonderful editorial cartoon some years ago when the New York Daily News was up for sale, and various media companies were competing. Who was going to buy the Daily News? I think the Chicago Tribune Corporation eventually bought it. But anyway, this was when it was in the headlines. Oh, who's going to buy the Daily News? So in the cartoon, there's three hard hat workers during their lunch break, and they're sitting on the sidewalk against the building, taking sandwiches out of their lunch boxes. And one of them turns to the other and says, "Hey, why don't we buy the Daily News?" And you know, we laugh because we know
you guys can't have a news.
Yeah, that workers couldn't possibly afford the multi-million-dollar media price tag.
Mm-hmm.
But that sort of sets the stage for mm-hmm. you know, what the media, why the media is what it is today, and then what will the media be like under socialism when there are no, presumably there are no corporate corporations to control the media, control the articles. And there won't be TV commercials for Coke cars or million-dollar condos.
Oh, my gosh. Bob Dylan won't be doing commercials for the GM or whatever.
That's right. And
what could be more American?
You know, so there'll be no corporations to create the news. And what I've tried to write in my, it was just a brief chapter, but I gave a number of examples, is that if society is basically run by and for working people, the media will also be run by and for working people. It doesn't mean that there'll be one media corporation that will put out all the news. On the contrary, there'll be a real diversity. And you could have many organizations, from unions, working class organizations, from unions to housing and block associations to arts groups and so on, putting out media about their concerns. And I try to give some examples in my chapter of what some of the stories that, you know, might be, what some of the articles might be. I mean, there'd be no shortage of articles, and it's just, you can have everything from, today, under capitalism, the media presents news and views. The question is whose news and whose views. Mm-hmm. And it's almost always the news and views about the government, wealthy people, corporations, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So under a working class run society, it would be news and views of working people. And any number of things, from, you know, the production, how to produce things better, and what's wrong with the production, if there's something wrong with it. I give some examples of, you could have a union theater group, mm-hmm. that's part of a new workers theater league that is often in the cultural section of the media, and they produce new dramas written by workers, as well as some of the old popular pieces like Three Penny Opera, Waiting for Lefty, mm-hmm. West Side Story, what have you.
Yeah, because such things have happened, by the way. There have been theater groups that were produced by workers, performed by them, and also all the publicity done by them.
That's right. Go ahead.
A somewhat suppressed history, you might call it.
No, I think that the... that's why I say the new... There was something called the Workers' Theater League many years ago, and it was followed by something called the New Theater League, but they continued to do that for many, many years. Generally not known today either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, by the way, there are people like Blitzstein and Bernstein, and
right.
And you mentioned the author of Waiting for Lefty, and
right.
That was a vibrant culture, which, by the way, got cannibalized by the capitalist class. They took bits and pieces and bought people. But,
right.
But and basically undermined it. But they demonstrated it was viable and it was attracting crowds.
Right. There's a small theater group in New York that I just went to a production they did of Waiting for Lefty about 3 weeks ago, and it was very good. But it's off Broadway and it's not written up. And you do have a few people still trying this. But of course, if the society were run by working people. And the unions were, so then the media would be full of this stuff and would have a lot of reviews and discussions and debates and, you know, mm-hmm. descriptions of that type of theater.
Mm-hmm.
And as well as in the case of Waiting for Lefty, Odets, it was probably his best play, and after that he moved fairly quickly to the right.
Mm-hmm.
But that could be another discussion in the media.
Yeah. Well, there, of course, you're talking about a society in which is decided to has been established it is socialist, and there a little body of capitalists wouldn't be able to buy somebody off.
Exactly. And there is a part of the book, not my chapter, but there's a part of the book which discusses how to make a socialist America, getting there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very short part, because most of the book deals with what people think socialism would be like. And in this book on how to make a socialist America, obviously there are different points of view, and I'm not sure that all the people contributed would agree at all.
Would you agree, Fred, that there's I guess the word is intellectual ferment at the moment. A very noted gentleman, Russell. What is it? I can't remember the
Brand.
Yes, Russell Brand. Yes. Who is speaking up? And of course, Chris Hedges and others.
Absolutely.
They're all beginning, and I think in the case of Russell Brand, he does posit socialism as a solution.
Uh huh.
And people are arguing, well, yeah. You know, he has various people that he's involved with, like Oliver Stone, and they all, and it's a question about the quality of their of the vision, you might say. But it is certainly, suddenly millions of people are hearing about this, and as far as Russell Brand's concerned, it's going to be top of his agenda.
I think there is a feeling, well, some people would say it won't work, or how do we get there, or, you know, I mean, I'm not talking about the Reagan position that, well, there's no alternative to capitalism, because I think by now it's one of the good things about the Occupy movement was that they established this idea of the 1% and the 99% as a widely popular
mm-hmm.
got a lot of understanding for that. Mm-hmm. And if the 1% are getting richer and richer, and the rest of us, the prices are going up, and the, you know, unemployment is going up, and even the food stamps are being cut. So I think people are increasingly looking to do something about the situation.
Yeah, it could be mentioned, but it is often, again, it probably isn't mentioned enough, even though the gentleman is not terribly highly regarded. But you have a senator, United States Senator from Vermont, who does say
right.
that he's a socialist.
Bernie Sanders, right.
Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Well, I while you mention, while we're mentioning people, I thought I would read you something, and then
please do.
related to this, very, very briefly, and see if you can figure out who said it. Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. Increasingly, by choice or by accident, this is the role our nation has taken. The role of those who make peaceful revolution impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that come from the immense profits of overseas investment.
Yeah. I don't want to guess. I think I know the answer, so I bet.
Oh.
Well, I guess you want me to guess? Yeah. Jack Kennedy?
No, actually, he said part of it was quoted by, but the person who gave the whole paragraph quoted that and then went on with the part about today, what's happening, or not today, but at the time that he said it. It was Martin Luther King.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah. And people just don't know that he said that. Of course, that was a year before he was killed.
Yeah. Well, and it is interesting. That was in the mouths of people that I recognize piece of that. I know that Jack and Bobby Kennedy both started as members of the American elite. They were sort of doing that Roosevelt thing of warning the others, you know, not to overdo it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's here's Martin Luther King sort of a symbol of pacifism, mm-hmm. making this statement, mm-hmm. and if he could say that and feel it as he obviously did, the door has been pushed open, and I think a lot of people are going to be moving one way or another in that direction. I don't mean I'm not sure what all the ways are, but I think it's going to require organization, and I think one of the organizations could easily be, just interestingly enough, that one could organize community-based media,
mm-hmm.
Either radio or, well, like, there aren't too many programs like yours, but one could, if one has a community.
You're right about that.
A community-based radio station, mm-hmm. really develop ties with organizations in the community, whether they're unions or environmental groups or tenants associations and so on, student groups, that would then produce programs, get them on the air, and also help raise money for it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, indeed. it seems to me one of the things that is underlined is that, you know, the Occupy movement showed, and this language of the 1%,
right,
and that there is and Russell Brand and the arguments he's been in, the BBC interview he did, which has got everybody's attention. It's very important that a book such as this, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and your essay about journalism, be seen, because people are uncomfortable and unhappy, and they, by the way, it's not a revelation to the ordinary American that the place is run by the super rich.
Right, exactly.
And unless people talk about, well, what would you do about that to have a humane society, a society of mutual respect amongst people, it's got to be, without socialist ideas, there's a lot of other ideas that are not so nice that can be heard
exactly.
far and wide.
No, and I think the other thing is that if it really is a media, if the media are published or broadcast or on air or including blogs and internet pieces and so on, websites that really open up, that are really run by people at the grassroots, working people and working class organizations, there will be differences of opinion on a lot of these things, but there'll be differences of opinion sort of on the same side, within mm-hmm. the family, within the same class.
Yes.
And that's fine. There should be discussions. And
it's like that old title, All of Us or None, right?
Right, exactly.
We're all of us together. They're not nobody gets left out or defined as not part of the of humanity.
Right, exactly. So I would love to hear, by the way, if people can get the book and or just find my piece on Salon. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you can still get it. I guess you can. I'm sure they don't.
I saw it there, yes.
Yeah, but I would love to hear what people think, and if they have any questions or your listeners, you know, any comments, criticisms, even epithets.
Yeah.
But just to you can get in touch with me, I think, through the publisher and, or Google me or something.
Well, I agree. And by the way, they should have your book, The Einstein File, about J. Edgar Hoover's problem with the socialist Einstein, and, of course, Einstein on race and racism, and Einstein on Israel and Zionism. These are really important books, and the author is Fred Jerome, and the article, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, the essay on the media, socialist media.
First Class News, it's called.
Yeah, and well, we all like the Goodbye Russ part too, and that's at Salon, and it's January 18, 2014. Fred Jerome, we're very grateful you took the time. It was good, very informative.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Phil. It was fun, and I always enjoy talking with you, and your program is terrific.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Fred Jerome, thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Right, bye-bye.
Yeah, it's Fred and I share. We think so. Should be all right.
The novel that you wanted to make reference to was called The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. And boy, it is so timely today. It was published in 1906. But I think everything he talks about in that novel is still the problem, only it's worse.
Yeah. Absolutely. No. you know, they passed a new food safety act in, I think it was 1960-something, and they brought Upton Sinclair there. And he said, well, this is my second trip to the White House to be thanked. And it had been 50 years previous or so that he had exposed the meat industry. But they have to be watched. Obviously, it needed to be updated. We live in you have monopoly not only in news, but you have monopoly with handling food. One little mistake, and you can have a big problem. Upton Sinclair. I was reading an essay by, of all people, Arthur Koestler, and he wrote an essay in which he said, "Who would if you judge a country's literature, by his method was if you took this one guy away, what would you have?" And he said the biggest loss in American literature would be Upton Sinclair, and therefore he's, in his view, the most important American author. It's probably proof of that is that he's largely neglected, and efforts are made to diminish his reputation. He once ran for the governor of California in 1933 or 34, and almost was elected. It took the entire monopoly capitalist class of California and the United States, together with Franklin Roosevelt, to the Democrats turned on him. He won their nomination, the party nomination, but the Democrats didn't want him. But he came very close to winning that election. He wrote a book about it titled I, Candidate for Governor, and How I Got Whipped, so that you could learn from that. You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and in a moment's remaining, I want to mention that Beth Satoon at 612 Markham on February 22nd at 6:30 has a rent party. And what's going to happen at the rent party?
Well, people are going to have a very good time. There's lots of music. There's lots of food. There's a sliding scale of $20 to $50. This is to help pay the rent. It's Saturday, February 22nd, 6:30 p.m. to 10 p.m., and they are referring to it as the annual fundraising event for Beth Satoon. And I'll just read a little bit of this. Flavors and sounds of Beth Satoon, amazing performance from very generous friends who have donated their time and talent to create the exciting evening. Beth Satoon's annual open house anniversary fundraising concert has become a party of music and highlight of the year. Join the Beth Satoon community for an evening of Middle Eastern sounds and flavors. to go along with sharing and warm friendship. So they're
terrific.
They want you to come out on
the annual
Saturday.
Red Party, February 22nd, 6:30 to 10 o'clock, Beth Satoon.
And by the way, a socialist vision, a socialist America, you would have institutions like this would not have to worry about paying the rent. That's the idea.
They would just be there, and you could just go. That would be there'd be a places would be stable. You wouldn't go buy a store 1 week and go back by the next week and there's a whole new outfit there waiting to starve to death in place of the one previously starved to death.